Okay. I'd like to take just a moment before I get started and say thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join me and hear about my fireside project. My name is Jeff Perries. I'm a C-Sharp XAML UI developer and a Windows platform development MVP. I'm also working on making some games with Unity 3D, and I guess I can officially consider myself a hardware tinkerer now as well. Over on drums, I have Morten Nielsen. Extra special thanks to him for agreeing to be my moderator today. If you're not familiar with Morten, he's also a Windows Platform Development MVP. Professionally, he's the dev lead for the ArcGIS Runtime SDK for .NET, and he's gotten that running in all kinds of cool places. Most recently, I think I saw on Raspberry Pi. He's also a mapping geek and a home automation tinkerer, which is also how he and I cross paths. Also, I'd say I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Morten wrote one of my favorite apps for the Windows Phone, the Solar Charger. So if you don't have that one, go check it out. My presentation today is about a hobby project I worked on with a friend of mine that was a great opportunity for me to start getting into Arduino and playing around with some hardware. And I wanted to share some of that knowledge with you. My presentation kind of goes in three sections. The first part focuses on the Arduino hardware bits and pieces. And then I'm going to follow that up with a high-level overview of the firmware. And then I'm going to wrap things up talking about the client software application. So the thing I have to say is, unfortunately, I only have about an hour here, and there's a huge amount of information to share. And so I couldn't go as deep into everything as I'd have liked, but hopefully this will be enough to give you a little nudge in the right direction and maybe take away any fear you have of starting to jump into to some of the hardware. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and get started here. A good place to start this conversation for me is by explaining a little bit about what the Fireside device is and where it came from. I like to cook, in the oven on my grill, also make some barbecue, which requires a low heat for a long period of time. Looking around on the market, there's some devices that do remote temperature monitoring, but none of them really catered specifically to the Windows ecosystem in my house. So the best way for me to get what I wanted was to get out there and build it. You'll see IoT listed on this slide here, just in case you're not familiar with that term. That stands for Internet of Things. When somebody starts talking about IoT, they're referring to objects or devices that have an IP address for internet connectivity, and then also the communication between the devices and the internet-enabled systems, such as like a cloud backend for storing usage data. Fireside is intended to be a compact, remote temperature monitoring system that allows someone to not be chained up in their kitchen or backyard or to their device necessarily. And in contrast to, so-called smart appliances that are starting to filter their way into the market, the Fireside project is completely portable. You can use it in your oven, you can use it on your grill, your barbecue pit, and if you want, you can even take it over to a friend's house and put it on their network and use it over there. So I'm going to talk more about this in a little bit, but all I have to really do is get the device up on the Wi-Fi network, pair it to the client system, and then you're pretty much ready to start cooking. And I think as we were developing the hardware and the client application, the portability aspect of the device is kind of what inspired me for the Fireside name. It was kind of one of those developer things where I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and kind of went, oh, that's like a really good idea for a name. This is wherever you're cooking, the device is going to work as long as there's a Wi-Fi network. So this was done strictly as a hobby project to build a couple of devices for fun and see how it works. But I think one of the things that's fair game for discussion is the potential for productizing something like this. And when you look at the market, the Windows ecosystem, all the devices that are out there, there's a strong argument to be made for something along these lines. A lot of full-size appliances are coming out with the built-in smarts, but there's some caveats to some of those. Recently, I caught a presentation by a local company here in Portland, and they had some kind of interesting data points to consider. For this type of technology, the Internet of Things or smart technology, millennials are the main early adopters. So I don't know how familiar you are with the millennial term, but millennials are roughly defined as people that are born somewhere between 1982 or so and 2004-ish. So of the early adopters, 68% of them rent. 68%. Since they're renting rather than buying, they may be interested in something portable versus investing in a high-end oven that they can pair their phone to, since renters, 50% of them move within 1 year. So the interesting thing about this company that gave the presentation is that they specialize in helping create a space where someone's smart appliance profile is portable. So if they move, say, between apartments, to a bigger apartment. They can continue to pair and use the devices they've used in the past in the manner that they're used to using them. And basically, this company just shifts the profile over for them to the new spot. The cost there, of course, is that their information is stored someplace that's outside of their control. And some people are okay with that, and some people are not. So that kind of leads me into my description of the kind of hardware you need to get to build a remote temperature monitoring device like the Fireside. And first up is the Adafruit ProTrinket, and this is a 5-volt board here. This is pretty much the main brains of the device and where you upload the firmware program to run. It's actually really small. It's probably not obvious on this slide since it's not really to scale, but it's only about 1.5 inches by, you know, roughly a half inch or so without the pin headers. And the pin headers are the little blocks that are used to mount it to a board. It has 16 megahertz clock rate, 28K of flash, and there's a little bootloader on the device that uses up 4K. But all total, that means the biggest program you can squeeze on there is roughly 28,700 bytes. There's also a micro USB port that you can see on the left side of the picture there. You can use that for power and or programming. And then there's a couple other bells and whistles on there, like a reset button, green LED power indicator, and also a red LED. And depending on how much you want to dig around to save a few dollars, you can search for different sources of parts, but you can order most of this stuff off of Adafruit.com, and especially the first two parts that I'm showing here came from there. Next up is the Wi-Fi module, which you can see here. That's about $35, and this is the most expensive of all the hardware pieces. This is a pretty powerful little Wi-Fi chip if you're familiar with networking. It supports both TCP and UDP protocols, and I'll talk more about those in a couple of minutes. And then also supports the 802.11b and g Wi-Fi standards, and it can be used on open or WEP, WPA, and WPA2 secured networks, and supports both TKIP and AES schemes. So there's a lot of power packed into this little guy. Next up is the Bluetooth module, and this supports the Bluetooth standard and has both a master and slave mode. I'll go over the Bluetooth more in a little more detail in a couple of minutes, but the Bluetooth module is used as an inexpensive, easy way for the device to pair up for a user to provide Wi-Fi credentials. You'll also need a couple of replacement thermometer probes. These are the kind of replacements for the little digital kitchen thermometers you see at houseware stores. The price can vary a little bit, but they're pretty widely available. You can find them on Amazon. They may even be in stock at someplace like a Bed Bath & Beyond. And then next up is the enclosure. So you have some options here depending on how you're going to use the device. If you're going to mostly stick to using it inside, or you happen to live in California where it never rains, then you could easily save a few bucks and just put the assemble board into a little cardboard box and use it that way. I actually did that for a little while I was testing this one, and it works out just fine. If you want something a little more durable, these things are a great option. You can get some protection for the device in addition to a little battery power source that you can use in there. It has that one's a 9-volt, but the one that I'm using is four AA's. Out of the box, this enclosure is not weatherproof, but you can seal one up to protect the device inside in some other way if you wanted. These are actually really nice because you can set it on the shelf of a grill if you wanted, or add a hanger to it to put it on the handle of something like a Weber kettle grill if it doesn't have a shelf. You're also going to need a probe board, and this is the board that you're going to be assembling everything on. These things come in a variety of sizes and types, and the one that's shown here is for a more permanent or completed project, but there's also these small white ABS breadboards you can get to assemble everything on in a non-permanent way. They're basically small blocks with little connector holes, and you could just stick the wires in there and make your connections. And you know, if you hit one the wrong way or something, you can pull it out and put it back in where it belongs. They're not quite as pretty as a nicely finished project on a proto board, but the fact that you can change the connection is actually a big plus when you're first putting things together and getting a feel for working with your hardware. And this slide here is kind of the miscellaneous bits and pieces part of the list. You'll come across little bits you need as you go along. I think I actually neglected to put on here a couple of resistors. But the 2.5 millimeter thermistor meat probe jacks are used actually to plug the temperature probes into. You're going to need a couple headers you'll use to mount the trinket onto the proto board. Wire for the connections. It's relatively small gauge wire, and you don't need a whole lot of it. And your total for your parts list here, depending on how much you want to shop around, should come in right around $75. If you go without the enclosure and shop around a little bit, you can probably bring everything in for under $60. But I imagine you'd probably have to keep an eye on the shipping costs. If you're going to order parts from three different places, you're probably going to pay shipping three different times. So once you got all your parts ordered up and you're ready to go, you're going to have to collect a couple of tools you're probably going to need to help you along, starting with the soldering iron. And obviously, if you have a soldering iron, also going to need solder. If you go the ABS breadboard route rather than the proto board, you can probably set these two aside for now and come back to them when you're ready to make everything permanent. You'll need some wire strippers for cleaning up the wires you're going to be soldering. Or if you want to be lazy about it, you can use a lighter and melt the coating off. I know there's probably a bunch of hardware guys out there right now cringing because I said that. Don't use a lighter. The fumes are probably poisonous. For the enclosure, you're going to need a screwdriver. You may also need a drill. And then probably the most important thing that I can put on this list is time and patience. If you know the connections that you're making and you've done this a little bit, you can probably put one of these things together in about 3 hours. If you don't know what you're doing, your best bet's just to take your time and go slow with it. And the important thing is, when you're working on it, don't rush it. If you miss a connection, either part or the entire device won't work as expected, and it's no fun when that happens. I had a early pass on one of our boards where when we plugged in one of the meat probes, they both started reading zeros back, so there was a little short in there somewhere. So this, you know, quick and easy to fix, but you definitely want to pay attention to what you're doing as you're going along. So like it says here, keep calm, do stuff, and with a little bit of time, you end up with a really neat looking little device with cool blinking lights on it. So a couple of you probably noticed that I kind of skipped over the part of here's a pile of hardware, here's an assembled device. Didn't really cover the assembly part. So that was a test and you passed. You're right, I didn't cover the details of assembly. So I have to say, you know, unfortunately the assembly is outside the scope and the time frame of the session here, and it's also not really exciting, and I don't want to put everybody to sleep. But there's a bunch of great resources out there that'll help you learn how to put everything together, and time permitting, you know, I may eventually try and get a guide together to help make assembling the device a little bit easier. But for sake of argument, let's assume our hardware is put together and we're ready to move on to creating the firmware for the device. You need a couple things, starting with the Arduino environment, which you can grab from arduino.cc. The Arduino environment is free to download and use. And there's a bunch of tutorials and learning resources available for it online. Now, once you have the environment, you'll connect your device to your system using a USB cable. And that depends a little bit on the device you're going with. You might need to move a jumper to specify that the power for the device is supposed to come from USB. The trinket board that I highlighted a little bit earlier in the presentation, that's not a problem because that one is USB powered only. And once the Arduino is connected to your system, the operating system is going to try and install some drivers for it, but it's not going to work. So what you need to do after that is use your device manager in Windows to pick the correct drivers out of the folder that you got when you downloaded the IDE. And then after that, you're ready to go. You can fire up the Arduino application. The software that you're going to be writing in the Arduino environment is called Sketches. They use the Arduino programming language, and it's based on an open source programming framework called Wiring. You write sketches in the editor, and then when you save them, they save with the file extension .ino. So if you're not familiar with it, this is what the editor looks like for Arduino. It's pretty simple and straightforward. There's some existing libraries out there that help with certain functionality like TCP communication. You basically come in here and write your app. And then when you have everything ready to go, there's a little check mark button up there at the top left that you can use to verify or compile your code to see if you have any errors, fix everything up, or, you know, if you prefer the device connected and actually actively running the bootloading sequence, you can use the right arrow button. And that basically will do a compile and upload the sketch to the device for you. So a couple of minutes ago, I mentioned, when I was talking about the hardware, I mentioned the limitation of the Trinket, that there's 28K of flash memory on there. So as a side note, the firmware for the Fireside device clocks in at 27,952 bytes of the 28,672 available. So that is a little bit over 97% of the available memory that was used up. And there's a whole 700 bytes left over there that I can use to add some exciting new features. And you can get different boards that have more memory, but one of the things to consider is that in this context, using the device to send data to a client application, the limited memory space really isn't a major hit. I can offload work to the client side, and there's a lot more memory and a lot more horsepower available to me there. So the people out there like me that are used to using Visual Studio for coding, there's an option for that as well, and that is called Visual Micro. And it basically turns Visual Studio into a fully featured Arduino programming environment. And that looks just like you would expect, and is very comfortable and very familiar, and even gives us our favorite programmer's friend, IntelliSense. So in Visual Studio, you're going to end up with a Visual Micro item under the Tools menu, which I'm going to pull up here on the screen. Basically, you can see all of the options that are available to you there. And if I pop out the boards fly out, you can see the huge number of boards that the add-in is supports. If you look down there near the bottom, you can see that I have the Trinket 5-volt USB selected, since that's the board that I was working with. So we have our hardware, we have our environment set up to write our firmware. You know, in preparing this presentation, I sat down, I was thinking about it. I wasn't sure whether or not it would be of much value to show a bunch of Arduino code and try and walk you through it, since you're not really able to see the device working. And some of the code was in the existing libraries that are already out there. So basically, I ended up going the route of talking about the flows instead. So if anybody has any specific questions about how something was done here, I've got my contact info at the end of the presentation. You're more than welcome to contact me directly, and I'll do what I can to help you out with that. Basically, when I'm talking about the flow of the firmware here, I'm talking about what happens when the device starts up, what it is that the firmware is doing in and with the device. So on startup, the Arduino takes a few seconds to get going. Remember, it's only running here at 16 megahertz, but once it's going, it gets the Wi-Fi module fired up. Once the Wi-Fi is going, the device checks the EEPROM for a network ID and password, which would be there if we had already connected. If a network ID and password are present, then the Wi-Fi attempts a connection to the network that's specified. If the network connection is successful, then the Bluetooth module on the device is enabled to allow the client application to make a request for the IP and port if it doesn't already have it. If the network connection fails, then the Bluetooth module on the device is enabled to allow the client application to prompt the user for credentials and then pass them down to the device. So there's a lot of stuff going on here, but in the fail path, the Bluetooth module stays active. And remember, the fail path here, we failed to connect to a network or have the credentials available. In the fail path, the Bluetooth module stays active until the client application acknowledges that it has received the IP and port from the device. Now, I'm going to cover the messaging back and forth in more detail in a couple of minutes, but for this path, the OK from the client app is what tells the device, I'm good, you can turn off the Bluetooth. In the success path, in the case where the device has the network ID and password available, the client application may or may not acknowledge credentials. And this ended up being more of a quirk in the development cycle that kind of got left open, because if the client application has stored credentials in local isolated storage, I don't necessarily need to tell the device that I have them. And originally, the device was turning the Bluetooth module off if it knew it had already been set up on a Wi-Fi network. And that made it kind of challenging to get that first run experience if you take the device to a new location and then you have a new Wi-Fi network because the Bluetooth connection ends up not being available to the client application in order to pass the credentials down. Sorry, there's a lot of back and forth there. Currently, the way that it works is that the success path keeps the Bluetooth module on for a short period of time. And then if I need the credentials, I can get them from the client application. Sorry, I mean to say that the client application can request them from the device, but the device will eventually turn off the Bluetooth module, excuse me, in order to conserve some of the power on the device. So once all the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth stuff is done, meaning that the device has successfully connected to your local network, it basically just sits there listening for a message on the IP and port that's specified. The most common request that is going to be made on the device is going to be for the probe temperatures. And this is the core functionality of the device. The client app requests temps and the device sends them back. If the client application sends a request to the device for the temperatures, then the device takes multiple ADC readings from the probes. And then it averages out those readings and returns them back over to the client app. And there are some other functions available on the device, such as a client application requesting IP address of the device on the network. You can also request current battery level and that type of thing. There's room for expansion there if any other features call for it. So I was going to take a break here. That kind of wraps up my hardware and firmware part. And I was going to take a break here for a couple of minutes and see if there's any questions related to the content that I've already covered. I'm looking at the clock, though, and I have a lot of content to cover, and I want to make sure I get all of it. So I think what I'm going to say is if you have hardware questions, if you can hold those to the end, you know, remember that you can contact me directly. And if there's enough questions that I can't get to them, I'll follow up with a blog post or something and get those out there on my website for you. So I'm just going to skip that one and jump right over into the client application. So the client application is intended to be very simple. It's two screens. The main screen is instructing the user to pair the client system with the device via the Bluetooth settings on their system. So this part here I think is a little bit unfortunate that there's this long string of instructions to point a user to the Bluetooth settings since there's no direct access to that panel for me from the code behind. So that one kind of fails the mom test a little bit, but otherwise the design of this page was intended to be really simple. A lot of the functionality happens under the covers where the users don't see it because they don't care about it. And we'll take a look at what's going on under the covers here in a couple of minutes, but while this page is sitting here, if it's open on the system, the app is checking at intervals to see if the device has been paired to the client system yet. And when the pairing is finally recognized, then the fields on the form become active for the entry. There's also, I don't know how clear it is on the slide, but down in the bottom right corner, there's a skip button, and that allows a user to skip pairing with the device if they want to, and they can then just use the timers on the cooking page, which looks like this. So this page carries over the minimalist design with a couple of boxes to show the temperatures being reported by the device. The text in the temperature boxes, the little labels there, can be edited by the user so they can type in what it is that they're monitoring with the temperature probe, or if they're using the device to measure grill temps across something like a smoker pit where it's really important to have kind of a balanced temperature across the entire grill. The small target icons on the bottom right of the temperature boxes open up a little temperature picker when the user taps them, and that allows the user to set the target temperature for whatever it is that they're cooking if they want to use it. So, you know, chicken and turkey and fish and beef and all that has recommended safe cooking temperatures, you can pick that in here. Basically, what happens then is when a temperature meets or exceeds the set target temperature, that temperature box highlights and the application sounds a little chime to indicate that the food is done. Over on the right-hand side, there's a couple of touch-friendly kitchen timers that you can use to basically time additional food items like side dishes. And one of the key concepts for the design on this page is that it can be viewed really easily from across a room. If you have a system like a Surface, that means you could just set that Surface up on an end table, your ottoman, wherever you want to put it in your room, and you can see it from anywhere in the room. So that kind of kills that need to constantly pull out a device like your phone to check and see if your cooking is done. So this particular slide is going to illustrate the back and forth communication that's happening between the device and the client application. I kind of talked about it a little bit, but sometimes it's a little bit easier to follow if you're looking at a pretty picture of it. So if you look here, the Fireside device is illustrated over on the left. My Surface is over on the right. If I turn the Fireside device on, it does its little startup the way I described earlier and ends up with the Wi-Fi on. And it can then check and see if it has any stored user credentials. So I'm going to follow a first run experience here and say, nope, there's no stored credentials. So the device is going to activate the Bluetooth module and wait for an acknowledgement of client pairing. So at the same time, over on the client side, the app has started up and it's checking local storage to see if it has any credentials. If it hasn't found any, then the application is going to wait and check the system Bluetooth enumeration for pairing. And once that pairing occurs, once the device shows up as being a paired device, then the client can send an acknowledgement to the device that it's paired up, and then it can sit there and wait for a response from the device. The device collects the available Wi-Fi networks that are in the area and sends that list back to the client app. That's kind of a necessary step here because at least for Windows 8.x programming, there's no ability to scan for available networks. So this was kind of a little bit of a workaround on it there. The client is going to get that list of available networks and activate the form for the user. The user is going to, hopefully the correct network is already selected. The user is going to type in their password, hit the send credentials button, and the credentials are going to get passed back to the device. The device is going to use those credentials to sign into the network, and then it's going to send an acknowledgement back to the client application via Bluetooth before it switches over to Wi-Fi. And now that it's over on Wi-Fi, the client application makes requests for temperatures at a regular interval. At the moment, that's set to 10 seconds, so I would get temperature readings 6 times a minute, and the device returns the requested data. That arrow there on the bottom of the slide should be bidirectional. There should be arrowheads at both ends because it's communicating back and forth. And if I go back up to the startup and I say, okay, let's just take a quick look at the path. If there are credentials present, you've already paired up this device. You can see all the pairing stuff is skipped over and we just jumped right on down into the data request. So when I was considering options for the communication between the client application and the device, the Arduino, I mentioned a little bit earlier, supports both TCP and UDP. So there's a couple of main comparison points between the two protocols, and that kind of made the choice to go TCP a little bit easier. The back and forth nature of TCP just makes it absolutely ideal for this kind of application. The UDP is kind of more like a fire and forget style of communicating. You push the packets out there and they're out there. You don't know if the other end got them. You don't know if you missed any and you need to resend them. Nothing like that. More importantly for me here, the TCP connection is very reliable. The trade-off there is a little bit of speed, but again, for this particular application, it really doesn't make any difference. In some extended testing with the device, I've actually had it running really reliable, well over 24 hours. I've gone 26, 28 hours or more. And the only reason I stopped it was because I turned it off. I needed my system to do something else. So getting started up on the client-side application, writing the application, I'm not big on necessarily reinventing the wheel every time I code something up. And I think that that's a big part of the whole developer community, right, is when you're looking for someplace to start is you go out there and you see what's out there already and then kind of build on top of it. So when I was looking for my starting point on this app, I kind of came across this example application demonstrating a universal app using Arduino. So that's a pretty cool little project and a good starting point since the author put his code up there on GitHub that you can take a look at and use as a learning resource. So here's a link up there to that project if anybody's interested in checking it out. It's actually pretty cool little project. The main piece of that project, when I downloaded it to check it out, that was of interest to me, there was a class in there called Bluetooth Connection Manager. And that class saved me a ton of time and energy because it had some useful built-in functionality that I actually really needed to get my application going. So primarily, for me, that was a method that checks the system Bluetooth enumeration. And the call that's in there is like a one-time call, and basically I set it up to basically check for the Fireside device by name. So I have a starting point now for my project without reinventing the wheel. And we've gone over the way the UI provides a description for a user to pair the device up to the system. So making use of the Bluetooth Connection Manager class, I basically declare an instance of the class in my code behind. And that looks like the class that's shown here, or sorry, the code that's shown here. And then one of the things I mentioned a minute or two ago is that under the covers, that page is checking the system enumeration of Bluetooth devices. And that's done by checking for pairing at some interval. And the trick with the interval here is not to batter the system with the request. You know, assuming it's going to take a user a little bit of time to navigate over and complete the pairing with the device, a 10 to 15 second interval is probably a reasonable starting point. And you can always modify that later based on user testing also. Because we all do user testing, right? People unfamiliar with how to pair a device will probably take a little bit longer to get it set. But as soon as the pairing is recognized by the application, the UI displays a progress bar in an indeterminate state, the little chasing dots you're familiar with. And that way the user knows something is happening in the system. The call for the device check is in an async method, and the code for that looks like this. And then just to reiterate one more time, the enumerate devices async method finds all of the Bluetooth devices to which the system is currently paired. So the experience for a pairing process of a Bluetooth device might look familiar to some of you. In case you haven't seen it, pairing the device on the Bluetooth device page in Windows looks like this. It prompts a user for a Bluetooth pairing passcode. Basically, the device shows up in the list. You hit the little pair button. It takes a couple seconds and then it comes up and says, "Hey, I need a passcode." It might have been a little small to see on the earlier slide. It'll probably be a little bit more obvious on the next picture here. But the instructions in the UI tell a user if you're prompted for a PIN, use 1234, which is what I'm showing here. So you hit that and you hit the I think it's a pair button there. After pairing on that page, on the Bluetooth devices page, returning back into the app looks like this. The app has essentially requested permission from the system to use that Bluetooth device, and the user has to explicitly give their permission for me to be able to do anything with it. So I've covered the pairing from both the device and the client side, but I haven't gotten into much detail about the messaging that's going back and forth. Next couple slides, I'm going to take to walk you through the pairing process one more time. I'm going to show a little bit of detail on the messaging and what's happening under the covers. All of the messaging between the app and the device is done with JSON. So let's assume our app is running. You know that the application is watching the Bluetooth enumeration to see when the device gets added in. And once that happens, the application sends a JSON message that looks something like this. And this message lets the device know that, hey, we're paired up via Bluetooth. Then the device is going to send back that list of available Wi-Fi networks. And once the client application has that, it makes a best guess as to which network the user is currently connected to. And this goes back to, you know, the access to the network resources on the system that I have programmatically. So this is done strictly as a convenience feature for the user to potentially save them a little bit of hassle from having to pick their network in the dropdown. And the way that it works is, you know, basically while I can't get a list of the Wi-Fi networks, I can get a list of the user's connection profiles. And that's the list of all the networks that system has been connected to. So now I know which networks the system has been on, and from the device, I've gotten a list of available networks. So with that, I can use link to do a little intersect on those two lists, and I end up with a list of common elements between the two. If there's no common elements, then that combo box in there that shows the network names just defaults to the first item in the list. If there's one or more common elements in the list, then I'm just going to use the first one. So in testing so far, this has been pretty consistently correct. If you think about a, you know, your home or a typical user at home, they might have 10 connection profiles. You know, you carry your system out to different places. Maybe you've got a work network and Starbucks and your friend's house and, you know, who knows what else. But only one of those profiles is your home network. And the list of available Wi-Fi networks that's floating around outside your house might include several of your neighbor's Wi-Fi networks. But the system, more often than not, is not going to have been connected to them. So worst case scenario here, the wrong default item is selected in the combo box and the user has to pick a different one. Best case scenario, they look at it and go, wow, it knew which one I was connected to, and they can just type in their password and hit go. So after the user selected their network from the list and entered their password, they're gonna tap, there's a little button there in the UI that says send credentials to send that information over to the device. And the communication between the app and the device is handled in two small chunks. The first one is for the network. And that kind of looks like this. You can kind of dissect this message here that it's saying to the device, okay, set the SSID to the value I'm passing there, which is highlighted in yellow. Assuming that the message is well-formed and received and all that, the device is going to parse it out and return an acknowledgement that looks like this. Says, hey, okay, I got the SSID. And then we follow that up with the JSON for the password. That message is handled in a similar way. It tells the device, okay, set the password to the value I'm passing you, and that's passed over. Now remember, this is all via Bluetooth, so it's close range and secure. You're not going to have to worry about this flying around outside your house. And then once again, the device is going to parse out that message and return back an acknowledgement that looks like this. So once that's done, the device sends back a little bit of JSON that contains its IP address on the network and the port that's used for communication. The client application parses out that JSON, stores the IP and port in isolated storage, and then advances the user to the cooking page automatically. Basically, they're all set. Once an IP and port are stored, if the app is closed and restarted, it goes directly to the cooking page to skip the pairing mechanism. There's no point in putting somebody through that every time. You already have your credentials, go. You know, I'm going to put an option in there, I think, to allow somebody to repair it, basically force clear the network name and password in case they, you know, something happens, they get on a different network and it's not recognized or something like that. So on the cooking screen, the requests and responses are being handled with a stream socket object, and that runs on a timer. Basically, the code for that looks like this. And the important thing here on this page is the keep alive property, and it does exactly what you would expect by the name. It keeps that TCP connection open automatically, whether or not you're sending data. And the socket, the interval for this request, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, is about every 10 seconds. I'm shooting a request off for updated temperatures. Okay, so now on this next slide, I know some of you are at work and you're busy doing things. Just take a break here for 1 second and listen to me, because I have to point out here a very valuable lesson that I've learned in this application. If you're going to get cutesy and make inside jokes in your code, think about whether or not the code will ever be covered in a presentation like this one. So a couple of slides ago, I noted the port number we're using is 5309. There's this old Tommy Two-Tone song, right? 867-5309. And I thought it would be funny, and I didn't actually look down the road thinking I was going to have to present the code anywhere. There's a little bit of geek humor in there for you, and I guess, you know, if you're going to code, you might as well have a little bit of fun with it. Half of you probably don't even know the song, and the rest of you are going to have it stuck in your head for the rest of the day. So anyways, in line with that, the method that I'm using to send a message to the device is called tell Jenny. The JSON for that message looks like this, and you can see that it sends a GET request to the device for temperatures, which is the TPS part of that message there. And that message is assembled in a variable that, in keeping with my theme here, is called message to send Jenny. And that is fired off to the tell Jenny method. And the device is going to reply to the request with a JSON response. And that looks like this. So when you're looking at this one, don't worry so much about the first part of the message there with the state and all that. But notice that towards the end, there's an array pass that contains the two thermistor values. This slide shows the beginning of the tell Jenny method in the app. This is where the communications are handled between the device and the client application. This sets up a data writer object, and it's used to send the message string to the device, which happens there on the writer.writeString method call. The command object being passed in there that you see is just the local string variable that holds the message that was passed into this method. So writeString writes the message, and then the store async call for that that follows there sends the message through the string. So the previous slide had the code to send a request. This slide shows the beginning of the code, the response. A data writer is used to send the data. So here I'm using a data reader to read the data. The load async 32 call there is the reader for 32 bytes of data. There's an important line of code here. That line just above it that sets the input stream options to partial is important. It allows me to get part of that stream. If I say, give me 32 bytes and only 16 bytes go into the stream, set the way it is as a partial, I get that data. If I don't have it set as a partial, I could end up in a situation where I'm waiting on 32 bytes and 16 is all that's coming. So when that 32 bytes never comes, your app is going to sit there and wait for it indefinitely. So I'm sorry, this method was a little bit long. I had to split across a couple of slides, but continuing on with that, the next bit of code in this method reads data out of the buffer as a string as long as there's any data in the buffer. And it's checking for the \r\n characters to indicate that I hit the end of the message. Those characters aren't visible in the JSON itself, but they do come back as part of the message at the end. So I'm using them to determine the endpoint. I got my complete message. If I get through all the data in the buffer and I haven't gotten a \r\n yet, I'm going to go ahead and ask for another 64 bytes. And one thing to note in here, I have this text block called TXT received. That's actually not really necessary here in this code. I was using it to echo the return data onto the screen for debugging while I was developing the application. That's basically the core of the send-receive code, but there's a little bit more going on there. The thermistor values that are coming back to the application are returned as resistance values. So we saw this message type a couple of minutes ago, and on this one I highlighted the two numbers that we care about, and those are the resistance values of the two temperature probes. So there's a couple of options for turning these values into temperature values. And you have the option of using a lookup table, or you can use an equation. The problem with the lookup table is that they can get pretty large. And if you're trying to do it on the device side, you don't want to use up your limited space putting some giant table in there. Alternatively, they can be converted using what's called a Steinhart-Hart equation. There's a lot of info out there on doing this conversion using this equation, which is useful. It's actually really useful because the equation looks like this. So I'm okay with math, but something like this kind of falls into my not reinventing the wheel bucket, and I'm going to go ahead to a search engine and see what I can turn up on it. This problem has already been solved. So here's some really cool looking numbers that help us out in the equation. The RNOM is the probe resistance at room temperature. TNOM is the room temperature in degrees Celsius. Beta is the temperature coefficient. And the last one there is the resistor value for the probe's voltage divider. So let me oversimplify this a little bit for you really quickly here. A thermistor is a resistor whose resistance varies with temperatures, and we know that we can measure the resistance. That's basically what the device is doing. This is a list of constants in the app. Knowing what I just told you, you can see how knowing that what the resistance is at room temperature and what the actual room temperature are help you kind of baseline things a little bit. The beta value here describes how much that resistance is going to change per degree Celsius of temperature change. And then the last one there is a resistor value. The board that I showed you, the little Pro Trinket board I showed you a little bit earlier, is 5 volts, and there's a couple resistors on there that cut the voltage down to about half a volt for the thermistors. And the beauty here is the C-sharp version of this equation. You plug the resistance value in there, and it kicks out a float value that is degrees, which we can then take and push to the UI. And the 273 in there, by the way, is a conversion between Kelvin and Celsius, because the equation generates in Kelvin. So I'm totally going to fess up here and admit that I got some help on this one. If you want to learn more about it, you can go consult the mighty Oracle known as Bing for more information. You know, there's a couple different versions of this thing out there, so it's probably worth looking into and finding out what you can about it. So sweet, we got all that done. We're done. Let's go cook up a chicken. Here's the app running in my living room where I can keep an eye on it while I'm sitting on the couch watching TV. And a little while later, here is my poorly finished Glamour Shot product, which is done cooking to my recommended target temperature. The last couple slides I have here are just talking about what my, you know, next plans might be for the device. And after all that great information that came out of build, obviously updating to Windows 10 would be really high on the list. That would make all that network discovery thing a little bit cleaner for me. And also the true single code base would be a plus for moving on to other devices. And that includes making the Windows Phone version even easier than it already is. And then finally, maybe at some point, evaluate a Raspberry Pi as an option for an additional platform, since the Universal Windows apps are supported there now as well. I think something else that would be a whole lot of fun would be to make a band app so you can get easy access to your food temperatures or notifications when your food is done. So, you know, maybe you're in your house and you have your hands full with the laundry upstairs, or you're playing with your kids, or maybe you're hosting a party and you don't want to put your beer down to pull out your phone every 5 minutes to see where your food is at. You know, wearables are kind of taking off a little bit, and they're replacing that habit people have of constantly staring at their phones. So this seems like a sensible direction in which to head with this. I've had my band for a little bit over a week now, and it's becoming more consistent for me to check my email and messages on the band than to pull out my phone. So I think that this is starting to leapfrog the mobile devices that we're carrying around. And then finally, the Xbox One app from the Universal Windows application, Universal Windows platform, would also be something that I think would be really cool to explore. If you think about that, you know, you could sit on your couch and watch the Super Bowl and keep an eye on your food on the grill without having to miss the commercials. Unfortunately, it can't do anything for you if you have to go to the bathroom. So I guess on that high note, that's it for me on the presentation. Here's my contact information. If you'd like to get in touch, you can feel free to reach out with any questions or comments you might have. I think there's only a couple minutes here for questions, but Morten, do you have anything?
I do have a couple of questions from people here. One of the first questions is, so how do you mount the hardware into the roast? If you have a link or video showing that.
That's kind of one of those things that you probably would need to do a little bit of research on online. The mounting, if you get the little headers, it's basically a little block with holes in it that the pins of the individual device components go into. And then you mount that on the board. Underside of the board, there's a little bit of soldering between the connections. So what you need to find out is, okay, I need to power the Wi-Fi module. Which pin do I need to stick the wire onto to get the power off of the device onto the Wi-Fi module? Same thing for the Bluetooth. So that's outside the scope here of what I wanted to cover. I don't think anybody wants to see pictures of, you know, wires on the bottom side of a board, but there's a lot of information out there. Check on the arduino.cc website. There's a ton of stuff.
I think the question also
was related. Pardon the interruption, Jeff and Morton. I really apologize. I want to allow you to continue to take questions because it looks like you have a lot of interest in your topic. But I wanted to let the audience know that while Jeff and Morton are addressing your questions, I'm going to be displaying some polls. They'll be on the left side of your viewing screen. If you'd go ahead and please respond to those polls, I'd really appreciate it. Go ahead, guys. Thanks.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Another question here. What about connecting it to all joins so you can get a toast on your TV?
I haven't tried it. I'm sure there's probably a tool out there to help you out with it. I think the thing that I thought was so cool about the device itself is getting you out of the kitchen or away from your grill. So, you know, if it's out there and it's an interest, I'd say jump on it, see what you can do with it.
All right. So do the use of Bluetooth communication have a measurable impact on your phone battery life?
The device that I was running it on was a Surface, so there's not really a concern for the battery life there. The Bluetooth pairing sequence for the application really only takes a couple minutes. So, you know, if you're going to use your phone, I'm going to say you're going to have next to nothing as an impact. You can turn your Bluetooth on, do your pairing, and then once it switches over to Wi-Fi, cut your Bluetooth off if that's a concern for you. Not a big deal.
All right. So is the code published somewhere?
It hasn't been yet because it's not – I don't think that I would say that basically this pass on it here, some of the stuff that I was showing off was kind of like my development iteration, and I need to do another iteration on it to clean it up and put it in a form that makes sense. But one of the things that we've talked about doing was publishing both all of the Arduino code up on GitHub as well as the code for the actual client application. And, you know, whether or not the client application code goes out there, if the Arduino stuff does, if I put the client app up in the store, it's something that you would still be able to download and use, you know, free of charge. So I would say basically maybe keep an eye on my Twitter or my blog site for that. And, you know, if we put it out there, I'll certainly make mention of that. But we definitely need to tidy it up a little bit first.
All right. So is this your first hardware tinker project that you've done, or were you already familiar with this hardware?
Well, the last company that I was working at was working towards a commercial solution for smart appliances, and I think that's really kind of what piqued my interest in that. I had basically demonstrated their device at the MVP Summit Showcase. I think it was about a year ago, a little over a year ago. You know, their choice was not to pursue the Windows ecosystem. And, you know, I thought it was a cool device. It's something that I want to use and be able to use in my house. And so the solution for me, for my ecosystem, is to create my own.
All right. Let me see. So can you also suggest some wire wrapping tools or techniques for those uncomfortable with soldering? Something that's more forgiving for mistakes.
Well, if you're looking for forgiveness, then I would say go the ABS breadboard route to begin with. You know, the connections in there are secure. The thing is not going to fall apart. The best way to get good at soldering is to practice soldering. So, you know, maybe the proto boards are pretty cheap. They're just a couple bucks. Buy a couple and maybe get some wire and just practice your soldering connections. It does take a soldering iron with a pretty fine point. The guy that I was working with on this one was the one that did the assembly on it, and he's got a much steadier hand than I do, so I left the soldering to the experts.
All right. I think that is all the questions here.
Okay, cool. If anybody has anything else that they need to know or you want to ask about, my contact info is there one more time. Feel free to shoot me a note, and I'll do what I can to help you out. So thanks for your time today. Thank you, Morton, for helping me out.
You're welcome. Thank you.